The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Well, on this officially first day of spring, we are celebrating, as you know, the Spring Equinox Festival. And I'm going to talk a bit about why we celebrate that and what it means and the great opportunities for training that we have at this time. It doesn't feel like spring here, but those of us who live in the mountains know that the weather can be very deceptive and conditions can change very quickly. So although it may not appear as such, we are actually at the point of the midpoint between winter and summer, which is what the equinox is about. Equi, I'm told, meaning equal in Latin, all things being equal or balanced at this time. Light and darkness, day and night. And nox, meaning night. So equal night, night in the sense of coming out of darkness or winter, as I understand it, moving towards summer. And that in itself has a wonderful, some spiritual meaning when you reflect on that. So we have this opportunity where things in nature are in balance and we can allow them to help us in our training. So why do we do a Sagaki ceremony or feeding of the hungry ghost ceremony at this time? I'll explain a little about that. It is considered to be the best time at these equinoxes for transformation, spiritual transformation, for us to change, to do something about ourselves, and for the spirits of the departed and those hungry ghosts who are stuck in woeful states of suffering to let go of their suffering, because there is this obvious change happening. And again, it may not appear as such out here, but we know it's coming. Yeah. So this is an opportunity for beings to, we provide the opportunity through the ceremony also for beings to let go of their clinging to old habits, attachments, things, views that create suffering. There you go. Just let it go. Just like that. See? That's what it's about. You don't want to hold on to that. You can get buried. And that's a good example. So I've been reflecting on how we can allow the natural things around us to help us. There's so much going on all the time that expresses training and the truth, and we're not separate from it. And it's interesting to me that our ancestors and our tradition make use of, and I think it's something that is particular to our tradition of Buddhism, the training and the willingness to make use of everything, absolutely everything in our lives and in our natural surroundings and unnatural surroundings, for that matter, for our training. Nothing is outside of the truth, reality in that sense. So, hungry ghosts, we celebrate the ceremony for the benefit of what we say the spirits of the departed, people who have died. As you know, we offer merit for anyone whom we wish to offer merit to who has died in the past, and in particular for those who have died in tragic circumstances, suicide, very distressing circumstances. My thoughts are very much going to those who are suffering in Japan. There must be many deaths over there as a result of the recent disaster, earthquake and tidal wave. And so we open our windows during the ceremony. It's a little chilly. We open our doors so that the spirits of the departed have no hindrances and have complete access to our ceremony and to the dharma and food that we offer. So during the ceremony, we offer food, as you know. We try to provide an array of foods that represent all different parts of this globe, foods from the sea, food from the mountains, the trees, the earth, and so on, so that all beings, anyone in need coming from any direction, can be satisfied. And of course, it represents the food of the Dharma. But we make it tangible, and we ourselves then eat it afterwards for their benefit, and also for the benefit of those bits of hungry ghost karma, perhaps, that we might be carrying as well, as we're not outside of that. We can suffer from that whilst living as well. The hungry ghost state is one that is suffering due to severe clinging, usually serious covetousness, greed. It is thought in Buddhism that ghosts appear because of some sort of attachment, something that they have not been able to leave behind in their lives. So, you know, it's not an unusual thing. Buddhists don't think it's strange to hear of stories of houses being haunted or places being having a strange feeling. There could be some lingering karma, something that a person might have had difficulty letting go of upon their death, such as a person, a place, some things, an experience, a tragic experience, for example. And so in this ceremony, we offer merit also for those simple experiences. But when they're very, very serious attachments, particularly due to covetousness, those we consider to be hungry ghosts. And usually it's associated, this attitude of mind, if you like, with a complete lack of acceptance of one's own Buddha nature, a belief that one is somehow separate completely from the cosmic Buddha, from the universal Buddha nature, and thereby one has to have satisfaction from some external source. So one is crying out for satisfaction, for food, for comfort, for help, but because of one's belief, one is unable to take it in. And so hungry ghosts are often depicted, and I think we have some in our picture up here, with extended bellies because they're starving, and very narrow throats because they're unable to take in the food of the Dharma. And so we do everything we can to help them. We appeal to all the senses by offering food, taste, to the sense of hearing through our chanting, through the symbols to get everybody's attention, through the instruments in the musical quats, as we call it, sense of smell, the colors, and so on, are all intended to make use of the senses for the sake of conversion of the hungry ghosts. And also, touch and feeling are involved. All of this is healing food for the mind and encouraging harmonization of body and mind. So we try to break down the barriers to let the hungry ghost come and eat. And we ourselves are involved in this conversion. We all know what it's like to suffer from this feeling of things not being quite good enough, and we've got everything we need, but it's not quite enough. There must be something else that I should have that would complete my life somehow. I know that has been a big source of suffering for me, and in fact, a good deal of what led me to Buddhism. So in the course of this ceremony, we're also converting our own hungry ghost attitudes, and perhaps during this time, giving ourselves an opportunity to look into that more deeply and really move it along, because things are naturally in this state of flux right now. Well, apart from the food, we have all the scriptures that we chant. There's a reason why we chant all these scriptures. The scripture of the Litany of the Great Compassionate One is an awakening poem, and it is an expression of great willingness to open to the heart of the eternal and to cry really to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to Kanzeon, for help. And true awakening is not possible unless one is willing to accept help. And the Gakis can't be transverted. The Gaki is the Japanese word for hungry ghosts. We can't really do something about ourselves if we think that we are separate beings off somewhere and we've got to struggle away and do it all by ourselves in our own little place and become perfect beings, and then we can join the rest of the human race. It doesn't work that way. We have to be willing to ask for help from each other, from the truth, from that which is. We can't do it all alone. So that involves an opening to our own Buddha nature as well. We recite also the sweet great gate scripture, which then opens the gate of the Dharma, where we find all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all our ancestors helping us in every way possible. And then we go into chanting the mantras, which are, you have the meaning of them in your booklets, which offer protection and guidance, and again call on Vairochana Buddha in particular, but all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for help in various ways. And there's a lot more teaching in that, but I just wanted to give you a taste of that. We have a lot of, we have scriptures and invocations to Avalokiteshvara, because great compassion is really, opening to the heart of compassion is really the first step on the road to the conversion of the hungry ghost, and really to converting our karma, to cleansing our karma. It begins with acceptance. Until we can sit still with and accept our suffering, we can't make any progress on the path. So that's the very first step. And the very acceptance of suffering is an act of compassion in itself. You can't sit still without beginning to feel the suffering and beginning to feel the suffering of others as well. And it's that being with the suffering that gives rise to compassion and begins to dissolve the attachments, the glue of clinging to what we think we should have, or the way we think things should be, the non-acceptance of reality as it is. We do these incense offerings during all our ceremonies, and in particular, during this one, we do a special incense offering during which all the officers of the temple who are in the front rows, representing the pillars of the monastery, holding up the temple, as it were, because the monastery is the monks and all the people who come here. And they go up to offer incense first. And on one side, a monk will sprinkle the asperge, will sprinkle what we think of as the healing water of the spirit, which is also great compassion, reassuring the ghosts of their original purity and cleanliness, that they're free to let go of self-judgment, the self-judgment that weighs them down, keeps them stuck in the realm of the hungry ghosts. So we're kind of, you know, wily about how we do things. We make use of everything. So we're encouraging them with the water. The incense itself, the fragrance of it is an enticement to the ghost to become interested in the fragrance of enlightenment, rather than the smell of their familiar delusion, our familiar delusion. We're often very comfortable with the things that are familiar. We know the smells, the sight, the sound of it. It seems to be a secure place. We don't realize the danger that we're often in some of our states of attachment and clinging. And so we have this incense to pull us out of that, to show us that there is something more, something bigger, that is much more delicious, the delicious perfume of awakening to the truth of our Buddha nature. So the monks who go up are reflecting on this. Of course, the celebrant is very busy during this entire ceremony, making offerings to the ghosts and making it as possible as we can for them to actually be able to receive the food of the Dharma. So it's a very serious business. It's a very widespread ceremony in the Mahayana traditions, and of course, as you probably all know, it goes back to the time of the Buddha, the Ulambara festival, and his disciple Moggallana, whose mother was in one of these states, and he was asking the Buddha for a way to help her. So it's a very old, old ceremony that has evolved, of course, over the countries and over time, and we have our own version, but it's very much like what they might do in Japan, and I imagine might be doing right now as well, which is a lovely thought, isn't it, at many, many temples in Japan. In Japan, it is called O'Hagan, the time of this ceremony and the spring equinox. O'Hagan. Hagan refers to paramitas. And most of you have heard of the paramitas. It also means reaching the other shore. So the time of spring equinox is the time of crossing over to the other shore. And it is these paramitas, this practice, and I'll explain what they are, that in fact is already reaching the other shore. The paramitas is what reaches to the other shore. I'll backtrack just a little bit. We have this beautiful old scroll, which you'll see again in the future, but it is currently being restored, that we usually have up during the spring equinox ceremony. And it is an old, I guess Japanese or Chinese, I'm not sure, painting of an old man walking with his cane stooped over on a path, and he's looking for directions, and he's receiving directions from a small boy on the path. I've heard it said that this is a reference to the famous Zen master Joshu. Nonetheless, it's a very, very important teaching, and I believe a scroll that Reverend Master Ji was given in Japan and brought with her, and we hope to have it restored and bring it back. And it shows the importance of being willing, of course, humility, being willing to be shown the way through any means at all, again, and the importance of giving up our old opinions and habits, and the necessity of transforming our lives from worldliness, from these old opinions, if you like, which is perhaps a definition of worldly mind, being attached to our opinions, to living a more religious life. Now, we have this wonderful teaching in our tradition of the in a verse that we recite at the end of each meal, in fact, that helps us to understand what this means. How can we, in fact, live in this world and be with this world and use all the things of this world and yet live a truly religious life and not be of this world? And this is really what I think, you know, Zen Buddhist training is about. Our verse that I refer to goes, we live in the world as if in the sky, just as the lotus blossom is not wetted by the water that surrounds it. So we have our roots in the mud of the muck, if you like, of our karma, of the world. I watched the news last night for the first time in a couple of months. And, you know, there you are, all these things happening, wars starting up again and disasters. And within that, the lotus blossom is still as bright and as lovely as ever. But it doesn't pull itself out of this world. So it's rooted in the world, rooted in the mud. It can't grow without the mud. We recently had this serious experience of our abbot leaving, of course, and all the sadness connected to that, and the disappointment, the shame and to some extent, a lot of upset. But at some point, a couple of months after it happened, I began to realize that came to me this image of the lotus blossom that, gosh, you know, in some subtle way, I'd had this idea that maybe this training was supposed to take place in some nicer place, you know, in some nicer way, out in space somewhere where it was all safe and beautiful. It sounds kind of silly, but it was like along those lines. And I was again reminded of, oh my goodness, this is it. This is the very food and stuff of training. And it completely shifted the thing for me so that I was able to begin to go deeper into it, accept it, and not feel it had to be different. You know, that's the thing. This was it. This is what we've got. And it was rich with opportunities for training and rich with nourishment for training. We wouldn't go out and set about to create such a situation. We would certainly hope it wouldn't happen again. Nonetheless, there we were, And where we, a month later, we are making use of it and we're growing as a result of it. And as I said earlier, it's one of the very beautiful things about Buddhist training and about, I think for me, our tradition of Soto Zen in particular, making use of everything. There ain't nothing that isn't useful, that doesn't have Buddha nature. So think about that, next time you're in a place where you're stuck between a rock and a hard place or a situation that you think shouldn't be happening, or you just don't know how you could possibly train in it. You can actually train right where you are in every moment. And that is a tremendous comfort. And that is what hungry ghosts have to learn. That's what we have to learn and what we do have to do to convert our own negative karma. And so in particular, at this time of change, we are reflecting on reaching, what is it that reaches the other shore of nirvana? What is it that pulls us out of suffering, that helps us to live in another way, where we really are living more from our Buddha nature, where we are more in touch with reality, if you like. Okay, so opinions. Reverend Master, this was Reverend Master Ji's teaching, letting go of old opinions. So I've been looking at that and realizing that opinions are very ephemeral. If I think about my own opinions, I can't imagine how many hundreds and thousands of times my opinions have changed. When I think of just one lifetime, I've felt many things strongly or not so strongly, and often through training realized, even before training, but through training in particular, realized that, gosh, it was kind of a one-sided view. There's a whole other side to this, and maybe many sides to it. And through the process of training and meditation, have been able to accept that and not be threatened by that, not to feel that I had to have this set opinion and that my life depended on it, that my career, future, whatever, how these things are, depend on this. Of course, it doesn't mean that we aren't human beings. We have our views, we have our feelings, but it's the clinging to them. And in particular, at this time, to look at old opinions. There are old things that we carry that we're just comfortable with that keep coming up, peripherally, that we just give too much credence to, that we really don't have to. We can let go of them. I remember a time when I was talking with Reverend Master Jiu about many, many, many years ago, about a monk who left and people who were having difficulties in their training felt very badly for them, was trying to understand, they were doing so well in their training. What happened? Why did they take off? What was the problem? What might I do that would cause this? And she said to me, there's often one old thing that people are hanging on to, one thing that they hang on to, and that can lead them right out the gate, or in our case, it can keep us fettered to our suffering. It can help, it can prevent us from just being able to move on and from freeing ourselves. So this is a time for reflection on this. In the case of the scroll that I'm talking about, the old man, if he may have had to take advice from the small boy, it is not wise to wait until another older man comes along or somebody whom you think is a better teacher to show you the way. If the small boy is showing you the way, it's best to go with it. And in the case of Zen Master Joshu, I think he started his training at the age of 60, which is a great example, and lived on for quite some time. I've heard reports of up to 120 years, I don't know, but nonetheless, was a very great teacher and great trainee. But he had to, older people coming into the practice are often taking advice from younger people. But it's not just to do with young and old, of course. Anything unfamiliar, anything that just may not be quite what we expect to be the teaching, to be open to that. And just to let go, just to sit still. Reverend Master Kodo had a lovely talk last weekend about the precepts and not being stuck with not the children in a particular classroom, not accepting the premise that if they were on a raft, you know, thrown off a boat out in the ocean, and there was only enough room for five people, and there were six of them, or I don't remember the numbers, but that they'd have to throw the dog overboard, you know. And they didn't accept this. They worked at finding ways of keeping the dog on board, which I thought was the idea of not accepting the premise, or perhaps of letting go of the premise. You can look at opinions as a kind of premise that we establish in our lives, or a standard that we set. It can be quite subtle. And so at this time we're looking at that. What am I leaning on perhaps a bit too much? What am I identifying with as me and my life and my view? And, you know, I remember years ago tutoring English as a second language. And it was very interesting to me. I had a lot of Oriental students from Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and so on. And I was part of my job to help them get into the school system in Canada, into regular English classes, where they had to work quite independently, write long essays, do a lot of research on their own, and they were used to learning more from teachers and by memorization and so on. Not that they didn't write, but they were frequently asked by Canadian teachers to write down their own opinions and to and then to develop the idea and support it and so on. And they had many of them had difficulty with this, and I'm talking about teenagers primarily. You know, my opinion? I don't know what my opinion is. You know, do I have an opinion? Do I have to have an opinion? You know, this kind of thing. So here I was in this, and I was a Buddhist, so I knew, you know, something of what they were going through. Here I was in this position of having to help them to find an opinion and then to support it. But I realized also in tutoring many kids, you know, we can tend to grab at an opinion because I've got to have one, the teacher says, and I've got to, and I don't, you know, even if I don't quite believe it, I've got to have it, and then I've got to support it. Now, that may be a bit cynical on my part, but I worried a little about this because I could see how within our educational system, if we're not careful, we can guide people too far into developing premises, if you like, opinions that aren't necessarily completely theirs. So it's, again, another aspect of this to be careful of. Look at our education, our upbringing. Reverend Master G used to say you have to unlearn everything. It's not that you don't appreciate it and you're not grateful for the teaching and the support of your parents and everything that one is given, but not to take things too much as, not to be afraid to explore them, not to be afraid to let the light of your Buddha nature, you know, filter through all of it and let what isn't useful fall away and what truly is stay with you. And thus, you know, in the sense of the spring equinox, we move towards a lighter place. Well, what is it that reaches to the other shore? These paramitas, this are huge subject, and I'll just touch on that. Most of you know what they are, but for those of you who don't, we have in our tradition, we talk primarily about six paramitas, and they are, they can be seen as practices of bodhisattva, or essentially the behavior of Buddhas and bodhisattvas, aspects of enlightenment. It can also be seen as living really our true life, living the life of Buddha when we are practicing these. I see them as gateways into a mandala of Buddhist training, the paramitas, leading up into a mountain of awakening. In any case, we each perhaps might find we enter through a different gate, a different paramita in our training. They are giving, which is in Sanskrit dana, or generosity, keeping the precepts, or sila, patience, kshanti in Sanskrit, vigor can also be understood as energy, steadfast energy in training, keeping going, not letting up, which is virya in Sanskrit, meditation, which is jhana, and wisdom, prajna. And of course, they're The Theravadins have more of them. There are actually 10 of them. There are others, but I'll just introduce those today. And so you may identify with one in particular, and this is, I think, a helpful practice, just as we do with the precepts, to find one that you feel you can practice right away today. Work on that and see it as something that's already reaching the other shore. By entering into it and by practicing it, we are already entering into nirvana and making that a reality in this life. We do not have to wait for another life for that. And when reflecting on this, I realized that for me, my major gateway was that of meditation. When I first came here, I didn't know much about Buddhism. I was attracted to it, but it was the meditation that drew me. And through that, within a very short period of time, found a lot of heavy karma lifting and the way opening for me. So this simple practice of bringing our minds to where we are at present, to what we are doing, essentially, when you do it, letting go of everything and entrusting ourselves to reality, to the truth. Reverend Master Dyes, we use the term radical sobriety. I like that term. That's another way of looking at it. It's entering into a radical sobriety, more sober than we've been, because our greeds, our angers, our delusions, our suffering, in a way, is a kind of inebriated state. You know, when we come out of it, we start to feel sober. Like, oh, I like this better. I can see. I can hear. I can see things as they are. Not setting ourselves up as separate beings. Not clinging to things as they arise, not pushing them away. Always coming to the center. So this is a paramita that helps us to, and a gateway to the middle way in practice. If you're leaning too much to the left, bring yourself a little more to center. If you're leaning a little bit too much to the right, bring yourself to the center. And I think I was attracted to it because it was very simple. You know, it was not complicated. I could do it right away. I could do it anywhere, at any time, middle of the night, whatever was happening, whether I felt good, whether I felt bad. And that's still the case. You know, it's always like that. And it always, for me, has been an experience of cutting through clinging, cutting through the fetters of that, you know, things that keep me suffering. I can be very worried one minute, I can be distracted, and through the simple act of meditation, that can be completely gone. And by doing this continuously, one gives oneself calmness of mind, peace of mind, and thus one is also more able to practice the other paramitas and the precepts in particular. I'm going to give you a short quote from one of my favorite Zen masters not too long ago. There was a master called Sawaki Kodo Roshi, who was a contemporary of Koho Zenji, Reverend Master Jiyu's master. Reverend Master Jiyu was sent to him. Koho Zenji sent Reverend Master Jiyu to Sawaki Kodo. He did not have a temple. He was a monk who wasn't registered with the Soto Shu organization over there. He was a very interesting man, but a very, very highly respected Zen master. And so he asked if his friend Sawaki Kodo could have a look at her. This was after, when he was thinking of certifying her religious experience and giving, making her a Roshi. And so he sent her, you have perhaps heard this story, if you've read The Wild White Goose, you know it. He sent her to Sawaki Kodo Roshi, and he sent a message back to Koho Zenji saying, "I have seen." And he, of course, was very big on meditation, Zazen practice. At a time when World War II was happening, there probably wasn't a lot else they could do. They could have been bombed any second. So he had his monks and trainees sit. That was about all they did, was sitting. You know. But he has some beautiful short quotes, by the way, in this wonderful little book called Shikantaza, An Introduction to Zen, by Shohaku, Reverend Shohaku Okumura, who is a disciple of Uchiyama Roshi, who is a disciple of Sawakikoto Roshi. And there's some very pithy, wonderful little sayings of Sawakikoto's in here. So in light of what we're talking about with regards to the spring equinox festival, he says, our zazen, or our meditation, is seeing the world completely anew after a long winter sleep. So I love that, like that, because that is certainly my experience with meditation as well. So I encourage all of us to have faith in our practices, have faith in our meditation as ways of crossing over. There's a freshness that comes out of meditation. Last summer, I was invited with Reverend Alethea to go to a Vietnamese Buddhist temple in San Jose called Duc Vien Temple, and the monks there often come here to visit us. And we were invited to help lead a four-day retreat for young people. And there were, by the end of it, there were almost 300 young people between the age of 5 and 19. Believe it or not, all in one place, all quite well behaved, and you know, it's quite remarkable. We were asked to give some talks, and in particular to teach meditation, because they're from a Pure Land tradition and a more devotional practice, and clearly they do chanting, which is a form of meditation, chanting the name of Buddha. They do it while they're walking. They have these wonderful. And can you imagine 200-300 kids walking in a big hall, all of them dragoning the way we did today throughout the whole hall for half an hour, all of us, chanting the name of Buddha. So, you know, they do that form of meditation, but it is has a more devotional flavor. And they were interested in what we did and wanted us to teach our meditation. So we did, and they were very keen on it, and they were all sitting there right away doing it. We, meaning Reverend Alethea and I, and we had the older children. We were doing this with the 12 to 19-year-olds. But it was interesting. At the end of it, one of the female monks commented very kindly that she felt she was really happy we were there, and she felt that we had brought a freshness to the retreat and to their teaching and their offering. They'd been doing this for years, and you know, of course, I knew that it had to do with the meditation. Because it just, in itself, does that. If you're letting go of these standards, opinions, premises, which is just inherent in the practice, then you allow that freshness, that awakening, if you like, from the winter sleep to come forth, and you see things in a new light, and you allow the light, as we are now encountering, more light to come into your life. Old arguments, old conflicts can fall away. You'll have to keep doing it for the really tenacious ones to be converted, but they will. They will. Every time you do it, it's an act of faith. So there's a freshness and a beauty to this. And this is just one of many ways, one of these paramitas that helps us with regards to this crossing over that reaches to the other shore. So I will end with another one of my favorite Zen masters, not so contemporary, but still very much alive in our practice and in our hearts, and that is a great master, Keizan, and his beautiful descriptions of how to do pure meditation. And I'll just give you a little passage here from his teaching. Know well that this is indeed the right gate to Buddhahood. If you are desirous of clarifying what your mind really is, let go of all your deluded, discriminatory knowledge and explanations. Put aside the teachings of the world and the teachings of the Buddha, what we're clinging to. Cut yourself free from all false and deluding opinions and sentiments. When you manifest the true nature of the one reality, the clouds of doubt and delusion that have accumulated will disperse, and the moon of your original nature will once again shine clear and bright. The Buddha said, should you, upon hearing the Dharma, ponder on its meaning, you think about it too much, You are still as one outside the gate, if it's more of an intellectual thing. To come back straightway to pure meditation, just bringing your mind back, as we said, is to calmly sit within the house. How true this is. And just as with that hearing and pondering, likewise, all your opinions are still not yet put to rest. Your mind is still hindered by attachments. Thus, you are as one sitting outside the gate. Just do pure meditation, and all will relax and come to rest. There is no place where you will not penetrate. Therefore, you will resemble one who returns home and sits in peace. And so, on this spring equinox day, may all our hungry ghosts, friends, spirits of the departed, and all of us in the conversion of our karma, find that true home and peace in each moment. Thank you. We take refuge in the Buddha. We take refuge in the Dharma. We take refuge in the Sangha.